Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The most frequently quoted line of Colin Powell's is one from the Secretary of State's own autobiography, reflecting back on his two terms in Vietnam. Powell wrote that, "Many of my generation of Vietnam-era officers vowed that when our turn came to call the shots, we would not quietly acquiesce in half-hearted warfare for half-baked reasons that the American people could not understand." Powell's turn has come many times over the last 30 years. He is the most powerful African-American in the world, and his term comes again tomorrow when he briefs the UN Security Council on evidence that the U.S. says could make the case for a war with Iraq. A fascinating feature of tomorrow's presentation is that in many eyes, the messenger is more important than the message. Powell has been considered the voice of restraint, a multilateralist in a unilateral administration. So there's an expectation that if Powell is the messenger, his reasons for going to war with Iraq will be reasoned, substantive, and definitely not half-baked. Connection listeners, do you trust Colin Powell to make the case against Iraq? How do you see his presence in the Bush administration? If Colin Powell says it's time to go to war, will that change your mind? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us on the program today is Johanna McGeary. She's the senior foreign correspondent for Time magazine, and she has written extensively about Colin Powell. She's joining us from New York. Hi, Johanna.
Good morning.
And with me in the studio here is General Bernard Traynor, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, former military correspondent for the New York Times and co-author of The General's War, the inside story of the conflict in the Gulf. General, welcome to the program.
Dick, nice to be here.
I want to ask you both about the Gallup poll that was released today. I'm not big on polls myself, but I find this one is a bit of an eyebrow raiser. 1,000 adults asked the question, who they trust more to deal with Iraq. 63% say Colin Powell, 24% say the president. Johanna, does that number surprise you, that gap there?
Not at all. I mean, Colin Powell has had a reputation for being a straight shooter, a calm guy, a man whose very tone of voice is convincing, authoritative, and reassuring. So it's not surprising that at a moment where people feel anxious and where so many other voices in the administration tend towards the hysterical, he's looked on as a kind of island of reason among the rest of them.
I think that's true. And he has an identification that really goes back farther than the president's. I mean, people look at the Gulf War 12 years ago, and he being the so-called architect of the great victory and also an instrument of restraint even in that war. So I think there is the identification with Colin Powell as a man who is thoughtful, and who is very conservative and very suspect of the promiscuous use of force.
And Johanna, you know that the shorthand is that Powell is the dove in an administration of hawks. But do those two terms, either one of them, fit very well here?
To be frank, that's baloney. Colin Powell is a very conservative man when it comes to national security policy. He may look like a dove in comparison to some of the real hotheads in this administration, but he agrees with their goals. He has never been a guy who goes to work for people with whom he fundamentally disagrees. His disagreement in this administration has always been about process, not about substance, not about the final object of the policy. And so insofar as people have come to invest him with their dovish notions, they've been wrong.
You say his disagreements have been about process. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yes. I think basically what you have is a cadre of people in the Pentagon who are gung-ho from this war, who have been since this administration came into power, and who are willing from the beginning to say, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead, the U.S. is having this war, and if you want to join us, great, and if you don't, too bad. Colin Powell doesn't operate according to that notion of things. He thinks it's smarter in terms of U.S. benefits to have friends and allies with you when you undertake something like this. And so his campaign, insofar as Iraq has been concerned, has always been to figure out how you get friends and allies to join you. That's the process.
General Traynor, if we go back to the months leading up to the first Gulf War, your description of that time is, though, of a relatively reluctant warrior, no?
Yes, he was the reluctant dragon on that, as he was, as he was in Bosnia also, and also to a certain extent in Somalia. Colin Powell feels that military power is the last resort, that you should be doing everything short of using military power. And in the Gulf War, he took the position at the very outset that the life of an American was not worth, you know, the couple of dollars for a gallon of oil. And he was willing to draw the line in the sand at Saudi Arabia, but not at Kuwait. Well, he was totally out of step with the administration at the time, and he just came around in time. But he was always reluctant to use force. And at the end of the conflict, he was the one that was pushing for a ceasefire and then getting out of the area as quickly as possible. As it turned out, I think that was a mistake.
We talk a lot about the Powell Doctrine, the notion of if you're going to go in with everything that you've got and get out as quickly as you can. But your study of Powell actually takes us back to the My Lai Massacre, 1969, right?
Well, I haven't written anything on that, but I really think that a defining moment in Colin Powell's life was the My Lai Massacre. It was committed in Vietnam in 1969 by a lieutenant and his platoon from the AmeriCal division. They had been very frustrated operating in the lowlands there in the middle region of South Vietnam, taking sniper fire, losing a lot of people in mines. And in their frustration, in this particular instance, they massacred people in the village. Well, the army tried to cover the whole thing up, and eventually the story was broken to big time by Cy Hirsch, the investigative reporter. And the army then conducted an investigation of the AmeriCal division. Colin Powell was not with the division at the time of My Lai, but he was there with the AmeriCal division during the investigation, and he was the G3, which is plans and operations, and he was the fellow that was the interface for the command, which was still very reluctant to see their scutcheon stained, with the investigating group, put him in a very, very uncomfortable position. And I think it marked him. I think he came away from that experience and saying, my God, if we get into war where there's no defined objective, there's no sense of winning, we don't know exactly what we're doing, it corrupts. It corrupts the United States Army and demoralizes the United States Army. And I think he brought that away, as did many other officers, for lesser reasons, perhaps. He came away with that idea that, listen, if you're going to use U.S. military force, you better know what you're doing. You better do the thing right. So I think that has marked him to this very day.
And, Johanna, as you hear the description of that time, do you see in that the same Colin Powell that we're watching now, that in staying with process, in restraining the hawks, he's anxious to see that the process not be corrupted, that things be done in the way that he feels they ought to be done?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's part and parcel of the same thing. Now that his job is essentially diplomacy as opposed to military, he's doing what a good general does. He's rounding up his forces. He's making sure the order of battle is effective. And, you know, he wants to be sure that before the war starts, you've got the best shot at winning and on winning well and on winning fast that you can have. And in this case, his job is to do that diplomatically.
And I think a lot of people were listening to the Secretary of State when he made his most recent sort of public remarks about this in the opportunity that he had to speak to the Economic Forum in Davos in Switzerland. This is about 8 or 9 days ago.
The United States believes that time is running out. We will not shrink from war if that is the only way to rid Iraq of its weapons of mass destruction. We continue to reserve our sovereign right to take military action against Iraq alone or in a coalition of the willing. As the president has said, we cannot defend America and our friends by hoping for the best. History will judge harshly those who saw a coming danger but failed to act.
And if I just draw our attention to the line, we will not shrink from war, that's what a lot of people picked up on and saying, well, those are surprising words from Colin Powell. But if you complete the sentence, he says, if that is the only way to rid Iraq of its weapons of mass destruction. In a way, General, you can read that as the remarks of someone who is willing to go to war, but reluctant to go to war at the same time.
Yes, Dick, clearly he hasn't changed his spots at all. He still is a conservative person. He was the one who came up with what is called the Powell Doctrine, which was kind of a corollary to the so-called Weinberger Doctrine, which kind of sets down the criteria for using military force, where you have public support, where you have a clear objective, where you have an exit strategy, and if you're going to do it with appropriate force to get the thing over quickly, et cetera. You know, if you apply it, apply the doctrine literally, you'd probably never use military force because the conditions would not all be met.
So, Johanna, when you regard Powell, do you regard him more as a soldier or more as a politician?
A good soldier is also a good politician, but there's no doubt that the fundamental characteristic of Colin Powell is that he's a good soldier. And if you look at his entire history as a man in charge of things, a person in power, he has always been very careful and very politically smart in knowing what is the moment when whatever arguments you have been making are no longer going to change the outcome. And so you salute and say, yes, sir, and you get on with the job. And that's the point at which Colin Powell seems to be at this moment. He recognizes that this administration is going to carry this through, and what he can contribute to that is making sure that we do it in the best, not the worst possible way.
Well, some 18 months ago, in fact, just prior to September 11, 2001, you wrote that cover piece for Time magazine in which he was called the odd man out. What's changed?
Well, the issue of Colin Powell being the odd man out at that point was slightly different from what it is now. When he came into office, I think people did invest in him a whole lot of hopes and ideas and aspirations about what they wanted American foreign policy to be like, some of which were perhaps accurate, some of which were probably misplaced. As I said from the beginning, I don't think that Powell has ever radically disagreed with this administration on really big goals. But he has definitely disagreed on a lot of ways in which policy has been conducted. And it happened to him from the beginning when he came the first few weeks in office. He said the U.S. is going to carry through on its policy with North Korea as begun by the Clinton administration. And a couple of days later, George Bush got up in the presence of the South Korean president who was visiting, the architect of a sunshine policy towards the North, and said, oh, no, we're not. The guy's a liar. We don't trust him. We're not going to do business with him. That left Colin Powell out on a limb. There have been a number of those cases where, certainly in procedural terms, but also in terms of, you know, which foot are you standing on at any given moment, when Colin Powell's been leaning one way and the administration's been leaning another.
Johanna, I'm going to stop you there. We'll pick that up when we come back after the break. Connection listeners, our number's 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation about Colin Powell and the message that he takes to the United Nations and the trust that he carries with him there, whether or not you see a change in the man or a change in your own views. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation about Colin Powell, Secretary of State, and what goes on behind those glasses, what he's thinking about when we seem to see in him changes and shifts in policies, whether or not that's us projecting something on the man who's consistent or whether or not there are those kind of variations in character. Certainly he's going to be at the center of global attention tomorrow when he makes his case to the United Nations. So this hour, a chance to talk with people who know him well, who've spent a lot of time with him, To get a little bit of insight there. 1-800-423-8255 brings you into our conversation. With me in the studio, General Bernard Traynor, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, currently Military Analyst with NBC and co-author of The General's War. Johanna McGeary is with us. She's Senior Foreign Correspondent for Time Magazine and has been tracking Powell for a considerable period of time. General Traynor, let me go back to you with the idea of the man as a politician or a soldier, because if I'm not mistaken, you say at one point in the book, I'm going to quote you here, of all the commanders involved in running the Gulf War, none was more skilled in the ways of Washington than Powell. Now, you look at the people who were all there at the time. We're talking about Bush Sr., Dick Cheney, James Baker, Brent Scowcroft. You're saying he's as skilled or more skilled in the ways of Washington than that gang?
Well, he certainly was as skilled.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at his background, he really didn't come up the military route as a warrior. He did command a battalion in Korea, not during the war, and he commanded a brigade, and he was an assistant division commander, all in peacetime. But his strong suit was not as being a warrior. He came up really the political route. Now, and this is in no way to condemn him for that. It was just the way that the cards fell. Subsequent administrations saw the value of this man. But it started out when he got his MBA out of George Washington, and then he ended up as a White House fellow and went to the Offices of Management and Budget, where he ran into two people that turned out to be enormously powerful and influential in his life. One was Frank Carlucci, and the other was Caspar Weinberger, both of whom became Secretaries of Defense, saw the talent in this man, and brought him along. Periodically, he would go back to the Army, but then they would bring him back to that political nest in Washington. And as a result, he learned how to operate. He admits it himself that he knows more about moving around the Pentagon and the halls of power, perhaps, than it, certainly anybody else in the U.S. military. And so he became very effective. Now, he never really was a policymaker, and I think Joanna alluded to this earlier when she talked about him being involved in process. I would best describe him as a facilitator, where a policy is developed, and he looks at the pros and cons of it, and then is capable of not only selling the idea, but also implementing the idea. So I would classify him as a facilitator.
Joanna, is that a good description?
Yes, but of course the difference is that when you're Secretary of State, you're now moved from being just a facilitator into the policymaking realm. And the questions that have always swirled about Colin Powell, certainly the ones that we were alluding to way back then when we wrote the cover story about where is he,
yeah,
is what kind of a policymaker would he be? At what point does Colin Powell stand up and say, this is what I think, this is what we should do, this is the right way to go, and does it in the face of opposition? And I think the outstanding question about Colin Powell has ever been, is there a moment when he would say no? Is there a moment when he said, this is wrong, we can't do that?
You mean doing that in a public way, because we assume those types of conversations go on in the cabinet room.
We assume they go on to some extent. It is really hard to know, of course, exactly how those conversations take place in this administration. I mean, does anybody stand up in front of the president and say, excuse me, Mr. President, but you're just wrong here? I don't know that. So, yes, I think what we're referring to here is a kind of public position in which Colin Powell is willing to stake his reputation and stake his job for a position, whether he wins or not. He has always tended to make a decision on the winning side.
I think that tends to be his track record, but there are a couple of notable exceptions. One of them is confronting the president, then Clinton, on the gays in the military, where he was very outspoken on that. And in large measure, the compromise was the don't tell sort of thing. And the other one was on Bosnia, where he actually wrote an op-ed piece, I believe, in the New York Times, where he did stand on his own 2 feet. But in general, the track record is that he will go with the organization after expressing his views on the pros and cons. And I think this is true in the current situation. The description is, was he a hawk or a dove, or changing from a dove to a hawk? Well, I'm not so sure that analogy is the best. suggest, I think the best description of it right now is that the administration has been playing good cop, bad cop. And the bad cops include Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz. And he plays the good cop. Now, listen, I will be able to work this sort of thing out if you'll deal with me. And that gives comfort to those who oppose the administration's policy. And I think this is the role that he's going to be playing tomorrow, as the good cop coming in and say, reluctantly, I have to tell you this, that these fellows are in breach of 1441. They say they're cooperating, but they're not complying, and therefore we really have to take stronger steps. I think that he's going to play the good cop, and I think he's going to play it very effectively.
Well, which is, of course, what makes him the person to do this job. I mean, you're not going to send in Cheney. Everybody's heard Cheney. They've decided what they make of that. They want to hear what somebody who they think might be changing his mind is going to say on this subject. So, absolutely, the general is right. He is the most effective spokesman at this point for Bush's case.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go first to Chelsea, Massachusetts. Ernest calling in. Hi, Ernest.
Yeah, hi. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for calling.
All right. How are you?
Fine,
okay, here's my point, and it's a comment rather than a question. I think that Colin Powell is being put in an untenable situation. He's being blamed, for example, for not allowing the U.S. Army to go to Baghdad in the first Gulf War, and now he's been asked to go to the United Nations. I mean, reluctantly, he convinced the administration to do so. However, there is no U.N. mandate to oust Saddam. Disarmament is what everybody talks about, but the U.S. administration wants to oust Saddam, and there is no U.N. mandate for that. Now, how does he convince the rest of the world that it is in the world's interest to put Saddam out as opposed to disarming him? That's my question.
All right, Ernest, thanks a lot for your call. I want to start, actually, with one of the preambles to your question about whether or not Powell was the one who made the decision about stopping the troops going into Baghdad, because, General, in your book, he's very much the person who made that decision or gave that advice to the president.
Yes, I would put it that way, Dick. He gave the advice. I mean, he was the guy in the catbird seat, in a certain sense, is that he was the bridge between the military field forces under Schwarzkopf and the political side of the equation. So Schwarzkopf depended upon Powell, and the administration, to a certain degree, depended upon Powell for advice. So that gave him enormous power. And he was the one that came to the conclusion that the war was over and that we had beaten the Iraqis, and he recommended that we stop the war. But that decision was not based on military advice. It was based on really political advice. So he stepped out of his military role as a military advisor and took up the role of a political advisor.
That was the whole idea of not wanting to put the army under public scrutiny or criticism for participating in a massacre of the Revolutionary Guard.
Well, that's correct. And the interesting thing is that the assumption on the part of Powell and the rest of the administration in 91 was that after such a terrible defeat, that the Iraqi military and the people would turn and depose Saddam Hussein. Dick Cheney told my colleague Michael Gordon that Saddam Hussein would be gone in 6 months. But that was based on the assumption that we really had defeated the Iraqis. But we hadn't. The Iraqis started to withdraw the minute we started to attack, and while a lot surrendered, a lot of them got away, including the best of the Republican Guard.
All right, Johanna, can you take on Ernest's point about Powell's position today and whether or not he faces the Security Council in an untenable position based on the resolutions that he has to work with?
Well, I think untenable is the wrong word here. The fact is that it was Colin Powell who persuaded the Bush administration last summer that they should try to march to Baghdad through the UN, and they've been proceeding down that road. There's certainly plenty of people in the Pentagon who say, well, you, Mr. Powell, started this process, so you now got to go in and secure victory from the UN resistors. But at the same time, I mean, it's a job for which Colin Powell is particularly well suited. And if anybody can do it, he can probably do it. And I think it's not just a matter of persuading the UN to vote on a resolution that authorizes it. It's a matter of shifting perceptions among a lot of people, most importantly, those in the American public, who feel queasy about going to war without some kind of international benediction. So that's what he's got to do. I don't think it's untenable. It's kind of part of the job.
Yeah, Joanna, you know, on power going before the UN, I think I could come under the category that let the punishment fit the crime. In that
you got us into this?
Yeah. The administration say, look, you got us going to the UN. All right, now you tell them why we're going in. I'm being facetious, of course.
All right, Ernest, thanks for your call. Let's go to Baton Rouge, Louisiana now. Dennis is joining us. Hi, Dennis.
Good morning. How you doing?
Fine. Thank you for calling.
I think you're projecting something onto the man that's not there. I don't think he's changed at all. I think he's about the ultimate example of a professional soldier in that that person hates war and will back up and back up and back up and try to do anything you possibly can not to have to do it. But by God, if you are going to do it and you have to, then get in there and get it over with quickly. So I don't think he's changed at all. I think he's a perfect example of a professional military person that literally hates war and will do as best they possibly can. And, of course, he's very professional and a brilliant individual to try to prevent it. But he is also one who will say, up, trip canceled, let's get in there and get it over with.
General.
Dennis, you're absolutely right. This is the essence of the so-called Powell Doctrine, is that the use of the military is the last resort. But if you're going to do it, you better have a clear objective and go in and do it with support and with sufficient power to do the job quickly. Yes, I think you're absolutely correct in your assessment of the man.
I just think for you thinking that he's changed, I think it's just a continuation of showing what a frankly compassionate human being he is. And that compassion, rolls right over into, hey, let's do everything we possibly can to save one American life. But if we have to, then let's go.
Dennis, can I ask you whether or not you look to Powell for direction on this? And if he says time to go to war, is that what you need to hear?
No, he's just the messenger. I look to the president. He's the messenger.
You don't see any distinction between the two. If he's what Powell says is a message that comes right from the Oval Office.
Exactly.
Johanna, is Dennis right with that?
Well, basically, yes, he is right. I mean, Colin Powell is only, let me put it that way, the Secretary of State. The president is the guy who makes the decision about going to war. I think it's safe to assume that Colin Powell would not go to the United States and put on this
United Nations.
And put on this public performance if he did not agree with the president on the fundamentals of the issue. That would be unconscionable on his part. I think the importance of having Colin Powell do it is the opposite of what the caller was saying. That is, there are a lot of people who think Colin Powell somehow changed. For them, it's more convincing if he presents the case. And for those of us who do not believe that anything fundamental has changed in Colin Powell, except a matter of timing, it has reached the point where I have to go out and say these things, then that's also probably reassuring for a lot of people.
But Johanna, there was the zeroing in on the late night news conference by the French foreign minister, de Velpin, who is saying, you know, under no circumstances should we go to war. It's the worst possible option, which, and again, I mean, I rely on people like you to interpret this for me, was seen as a slap in the face to Powell. Did you see it that way or no?
Well, certainly all of the reporting suggests he took great umbrage at that moment. Colin Powell does have a sort of sense of pride and does not like, especially as a diplomat, to be blindsided. And there are certainly reports that the French came in with no warning that they were going to use that occasion to make a big public statement opposing the war. Powell was said to be incandescent about it. He really hates being smacked around like that in public. So it may be that that played some role in his decision, and I believe it was only a few days later, to make such strong public statements in support of the war. But the fact is that it's not like the French suddenly turned Powell around, that mm-hmm. he's doing this out of pique. It has, I think, more to do with timing and diplomatic niceties and how you get your ducks lined up in a row than it does with any fundamental change in Powell's views on the war. I mean, he If he was going to be opposed to this war, he would have been opposed to it a long time ago, and he would have probably had to leave this administration because this war was happening as far as the rest of the folks were concerned.
He has a reputation of a man with a temper, General Treanor.
Yes, but it's constrained. I mean, in this situation, I agree with Johanna. He didn't go off and change his views because, in a sense of pique, Villepin called the agenda called for a discussion of terror, and then he was blindsided by Villepin, and he had every right to be annoyed. It was bad form on the part of the French, Colin Powell is not looking to go to war. He's been always on the side of getting rid of Saddam Hussein and his weapons. And if that could be done in a non-military fashion, that's what he was supporting. But he has now apparently come to the conclusion that there is no other solution other than the use of force. But it wasn't that he was either against the military force or for military force. What he was focusing on was the problem of Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction and their potential.
And Johanna, if the man does have a greater appreciation for operating in a multilateral fashion, where does that come from?
You know, it's an interesting question. We were talking before about Colin Powell's great political agility. And it may be that the lessons that he learned on his own rise to power suggested to him a great deal about the necessity for friends and allies as you do things. I don't know if that's directly, you know, the cause for his sense that as a country you need to do the same thing. But it's not a hard leap, and certainly all of the lessons of the Vietnam War that have to do with that kind of notion of operating alone could be quite telling. Also, I don't think you'd take on the job of Secretary of State if you didn't understand in some fundamental way that part of the business of managing American power is dealing with the rest of the world. And it doesn't mean just going out and ordering other countries around to do exactly what you want, but getting them to agree and go willingly.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-TALK. Are you watching Colin Powell in anticipation of his presentation to the UN Security Council tomorrow? As someone who will help you make up your mind on the possibility of a war with Iraq. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. This hour, taking the measure of Secretary of State Colin Powell in advance of his presentation to the UN Security Council. Johanna McGeary is with us. She's senior foreign correspondent for Time magazine and author of Time's cover piece back in September 2001, looking at Powell as the odd man out. Johanna has been covering him before and since that time. General Bernard Traynor's in the studio with me. He's senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, co-author of a book called The General's War, looking at the first Gulf War. Let's go back to the phones to Roxbury, Massachusetts now, and Siddiqui's joining us. Hi, Siddiqui.
How you doing?
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure. Another good show. And let me just say that, in the context of Colin Powell, that, you know, well, as a black man, the issue here with Colin Powell is that ultimately, you know, he's not his own man. He just follows orders. And I know there's a lot of controversy about the Harry Belafonte comment, but I think it was misinterpreted in many respects because of the fact that I myself had hoped that Colin Powell would resign early in his term as Secretary of State, because I felt that the Bush administration was using him and embarrassing not only him, but our community. An example would be when they had the International Conference on Racism in South Africa. Colin Powell was the one who had to stand up there and read the statement and lead the U.S. delegation out of there as to why they weren't going to stay. You had another situation where he was in the Mideast supposedly trying to negotiate a peace, and Rumsfeld and Bush were speaking directly opposite of what his position was in the Mideast. So, you know, we have a situation. Let me just make another clarification in regards to decision-making. He was following orders once again when it came to Saddam with the Desert Storm. It wasn't a matter of him saying, well, let's stop because of, for humane reasons. What it is that the CIA got intelligence to the president saying, look, Saddam's been on our payroll, and we know what he's about. We're better leaving him there than taking him out and unknowns getting in there and there being chaos in the region. So, you know, just in summary, that, you know, I hold him in higher regard than I do Condoleezza Rice, because I think she's just completely gone astray in terms of her identity and everything else. But the bottom line is that Colin Powell, ultimately, he'll go to President Bush and say, you know, yes, sir, what do you want me to say today? And that's what he's going to do tomorrow at the UN. So that's the unfortunate aspect, because I do have a certain amount of respect for him as a person, but I think that, you know, that the bottom line is that whatever he's told to say, he is going to do.
You're saying that because he's a soldier, and that's...
He's going to follow orders no matter what. I don't care what direction he goes, and ultimately, he's going to follow his basic instructions, and he's going to do what he's told to do.
That's a rather serious charge, Siddiqui, and I really don't think it holds water. He is a soldier. And let me tell you how that works. First of all, if you are in administration, you have to be comfortable with the policy. And if you're not comfortable, then you have the option of leaving, which is what the case is quite frequently. But within the policy, regardless of whether the policy is on the possibility of war on the Gulf or any other thing, what happens is there is an opportunity to speak and present your view. And this is certainly within the military tradition. But at the end of the day, the president makes the decision, and then, or your commander makes the decision, and you salute and say, aye, aye, sir, and go and carry it out. But the discussion takes place before the decision. The discussion does not take place after the decision. And if you don't agree with the policy, then you can turn in your suit. So I think you have a misinterpretation of how the system goes. Colin Powell is in keeping with the policy of the administration, and he has expressed his views as to how the thing should go. But he has never challenged the essential policy of the administration.
Well, you know, with all due respect, let me just say that I hear your opinion, but I can predict what Colin Powell's position is going to be based on what comes out of the mouth of George Bush. So that's a very unfortunate situation, but that's the perception out here, and it appears to be the reality.
Johanna, can we hear you on this? Because you were saying earlier in the program that there is and always has been speculation. And what would it take for Colin Powell to say, I've actually had enough of this administration or of this policy, excuse me. And in reference to what Siddiqui's saying, is that along the same lines or no?
Well, clearly what we're talking about here is there a point in a public servant's life when your conscience tells you that you cannot go along with the prevailing views of the administration you work for? There may be many people who hoped that going to war with Iraq would be that point for Colin Powell. I personally think they were mistaken all along. But in any case, it's apparent that that is not a point at which Colin Powell, for reasons of conscience or any other reason, is prepared to stand up in public and say, I think this is wrong, I have to resign. So in that sense, does he become the messenger of the president? Yes, of course he does, because that's his job. And his job now is to try to turn some goals that this administration has into workable policies, into ways of getting it done. But if he disagreed with that, I love to assume that he would have stood up and took a walk.
But from both of you, is resignation an option for someone with Colin Powell's background?
It is the most powerful option that Colin Powell has, because he is the one person in this administration who came into office with them with independent stature, with influence and power and admiration and respect that he had accumulated long before the Bush people came into power. If he stood up and said, I gotta go, that would be an enormous blow to this administration. And they know it, and he knows it. And that's why it's the ultimate weapon. And I don't think he's going to use it on... Ever, maybe, unless there's a place at which he simply cannot go. And this doesn't appear to be it.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. Siddiqui, thanks for that. To Amherst, New York now, and John's joining us. Hi, John.
Hi. Good morning, folks. Joanne, I have a real problem with the left, and I know you're from the left, because Colin Powell has always been the most favorite person of the Democrats in this particular administration for one particular reason. He has spoken his own mind. Would you completely refuse to think about or possibly, you know, even ponder is the fact that maybe in these little back rooms that we have with the United States government, the federal, the presidential branch, that maybe they are discussing that maybe Saddam does really intend to be particularly evil, more evil than all the left thinks. And, you know, the thing is, Colin Powell can leave, and it was a very interesting point. If he truly did not believe he could leave the administration, and I guarantee he would be welcome with open arms in the Democratic with the Democrats.
John, the point that you're making, if I understand it, is that maybe it's possible that George Bush and Dick Cheney have convinced Colin Powell that war is the proper option, and that's not a part of this conversation. Is that
right?
Well,
I don't think Colin Powell, I mean, he's really tempered his dialogue as far as how much reservation he has about the United States going against it. I have heard him say, we will go it alone, but no one's going it alone, and it's the silliest argument from the left. We have 10, a dozen countries who are willing to contribute to this effort. But we are not doing this unilaterally. You can speak all you like. You know, they want to believe that France and Germany are really still relevant. They aren't.
All right. Let me let Joanne in here if I can. John, Johanna?
I sometimes get the impression that you haven't heard a lot of what we have been saying here, because I think the line of dialogue from both me and General Traynor is that Colin Powell has not changed his mind, that Colin Powell is not a messenger for dovish views inside this administration in some fundamental sense. He may disagree with his colleagues over the process of getting there, but our entire line of argument today is that he does agree with getting there, and that may be the disappointment for a lot of people. I don't think you should attribute that to me personally, since I don't think that's what we're discussing, but in any case, what we have been trying to say about Powell is he hasn't changed his stripes, that he does agree with the administration, and he's just trying to get there in the way that he sees as the smartest and the most useful.
General Traynor, tell me something. Do we need to look at the actions, the decisions, the moves of the Secretary of State in light of his own political ambition? Should we be considering him for whatever he might aspire to be after the Bush administration?
I don't think so, Dick. I think he made it perfectly clear when he had the opportunity in the past to be on a presidential ticket, say that he really doesn't have that mind. And I think that's in keeping with the nature of the man, the way we've described him. You know, he's a man that is a facilitator and an observer and a recommender and so forth. And while he, in the role of Secretary of State, of course he has to make policy, but the policy is within the framework of the basic overall policy of the president. I don't think it's in the nature. Not that he isn't a leader, but I don't think he likes that sort of role, and I don't think he wants to be president, and he's expressed that in the past. I think he likes the role that he's playing now and a role that he has played in the past, which is, as I say, a facilitator of a policy that he agrees with.
Johanna, does he want to be president someday?
I think that's over. The moment when he could have run for president is past. He clearly did not have the stomach, whatever that thing is. You can call it ambition, you can call it whatever you like, that makes a man willing to undertake the awful business of running for president. Whether it's, in a lot of ways, I'm not sure it isn't because he didn't want to be president. I think he would have loved to have kind of been an Eisenhower figure, acclimated, you know, given by acclimation the job of being president. To run for the job was not in him. And I think that is all really past for him. What he would like is to emerge with a reputation intact as this country's most sane, wisest elder statesman. And if he can do that, I think he'll probably be happy.
Let me ask both of you what it's like to spend time with Colin Powell. I know you've both interviewed him at some considerable length. What kind of a person is he? What do you take away from a one-on-one, General?
Well, he's very courteous, very gracious, and he's a very good listener. not only with people that are interviewing him, but with his staff. He takes on board everything that people say and really keeps his own counsel as to what he thinks of the outcome. So in that sense, it makes him perfect to be a Secretary of State.
Johanna?
I sort of agree with that. He has a funny combination of candor and reserve. You know, part of it is even just in his tone of voice. It's very forthcoming. It's very easygoing. It's straight talk. It's calm. It's all those things. But in the end, it's also reserved. He does not tell you everything he thinks. He keeps his cards quite close to his own chest. You know, in some ways, some of that is part of his mystique, but some of it is also the fact that he is a very cautious man, who in the end is not going to let it all hang out. It's a very effective act. I mean, it's really compelling to people. And when he walks into a room and does it, a lot of people are blown away by it.
I mean, you've covered a lot of presidents, cabinet secretaries. Does he have a stature that is distinct from your average, powerful Washington politician?
Oh, absolutely, because he has a kind of confidence that a lot of politicians don't. And I don't mean braggadocio by that. I mean a kind of inner compass, an inner sense of who he is and what he's accomplished. And that keeps him on a very, very steady keel and gives him a kind of aura that a lot of politicians just don't have.
I think that's correct. I agree with you, Johanna. He has a very orderly mind. He's not one that is, you know, doing brainstorming. I think this is one of the problems you have with Les Aspin. When Les Aspin was Secretary of State, Aspin would be off the wall on a whole bunch of subjects. But Colin Powell, by his military training and also his political training, says, okay, here's the agenda. Let's stick to the agenda. Let's stick to whatever the issues are. So I think that makes him very effective. But I also think it reflects in his persona.
General Traynor, thanks for being in the program today.
My pleasure, Dick.
General Bernard Traynor, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, co-author of a book called The General's War. Johanna McGeary, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Johanna is Senior Foreign Correspondent for Time Magazine. Connection listeners, we invite you to continue the conversation in our online forums. We are at theconnection.org. And for those of you who will be with us tomorrow, our plan is to carry the Powell speech live from the United Nations. We will have analysis and be taking your calls at the same time. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.